So when we speak about gender security and technology, we're speaking more about the fact of how are these technologies designed and developed for security purposes, and whether there are gender oversights around that. How can we overcome those oversights? How can we make sure that these oversights are not carried into policy discussions? And when we have policy discussions about security technology, we're making sure that gender remains a part of that conversation and is not overlooked. So that's one. Then the other thing that we're also looking at is who is making these technologies, whether those teams are diverse and representative, whether the people in those teams understand gender sensitivities and can work around that to make sure that their products are not gender biased in any way. And then also in policy circles and in areas where conversations around governance of these technologies is happening, can those audiences also understand the complexities around gender? Do those places also have enough gender representative populations? So, for example, a research product by Unidaid from 2019, titled Still Behind the Curve, mentions the fact that only about 1/3 of the diplomats in any major forum around disarmament are women. And this metric hasn't really changed much since then. In fact, in smaller forums and in more specialized forums, like those around security technologies, only 1/5 of the diplomats present in the room are women. So this obviously then ties into a larger trend of the gender aspect being sort of a marginal consideration for most places, whether it's tech, whether it's policy, whether it's security and military applications. So my research sort of looks at where are these gaps, how have they developed, and how can we help to fill them by making sure that gender remains a part of the conversation and also part of the room.
Can you tell us about the negative impacts of this gender imbalance in all these areas, disarmament and emerging technologies, particularly in terms of policymaking, if women are excluded from the negotiating table or from policymaking arena?
So I think a lot of the examples that we come up with around security technology are also taken from civilian spaces, because the technology at the end of the day is the same. It's dual use technology, especially when we speak of things like cybersecurity and artificial intelligence. The same technology that you use, say, on your iPhone for facial recognition is the kind of technology that's used in, say, an uncrewed drone to target military objectives on the battlefield. So the technology, in a sense, doesn't change, but the usage of it changes. And because of that change in the application potential, we can also sort of foresee some of the harmful adverse effects that may emerge as a result, especially when we speak about gender. So we know from a lot of conversations around artificial intelligence now that there is a very established gender bias in AI, which is continuously exacerbated by the kind of data and the kind of algorithms that are put into it, and also the people who train them. So one of the examples that I'd really like to highlight here is that of the Apple credit card system, which was deemed to be inherently sexist because of the way that it would give lower credit ratings to women as compared to men. On the simple basis of the fact that they were women, there was no other difference between women and men who were applying for loans through the credit card system, apart from the fact that they were women. And once this was brought out, Apple sort of recalled that system back and then had to work around it again. But suffice to say, this is only one isolated example on a trend of examples that we've seen where AI bias is observed. For example, now we have generative AI, which has become a huge topic of conversation since 2022. We've seen ChatGPT, we've seen image generation apps like Midjourney and DALL-E. And all of them sort of have this perspective where gender bias is inadvertently built into the system. So, for example, in the initial versions of ChatGPT, if you would ask it, oh, tell me a story about a girl and a boy, it would tell you, oh, the boy became a doctor, was very successful, was very was well renowned in his field, etc., etc. And then for the girl, it would say, oh, the girl was very beautiful, very pretty. She became a really great homemaker. So that was the kind of bias that was built into these data sets without and without the oversight of the people who were building it. And when it came to OpenAI's attention, they of course tried to fix it as well. But then isolated attempts at fixing it don't really fix the entire model. So that's also something that we're observing, whether the bias is in the data sets that are being used, whether it's in the algorithms that are being employed, or whether it's in the people who are designing the systems and who are not taking these algorithms out of the systems as a result.
How can we address the inherent biases? And you gave some examples on the policy level, what exactly we can do to address these biases?
I think the three sort of ways that we can look at it from the design aspect is the data, the algorithms, and the people. And that's more of a substantive perspective. So when we speak about tech and representation, we speak about it in substantive and participatory perspectives. In substantive perspectives, we look at what's going into the system and what's coming out as a result. So if you are coding in biases, whether it's deliberate or inadvertent, those biases will come out as biased outputs as well. That's the substantive perspective. That's how we see how these machines are built, how these technologies are built. The second way that we think of them is through participatory perspectives. Who is in the room when these are being designed? Who is in the room when policy is discussing this? Basically, who's behind the technology? And how diverse is that team? How representative is that team? How gender sensitive and gender aware is that team? So this is where all of your conversations around representation and making sure that there's that we're closing the gender digital divide come in. It's well established that in cybersecurity, only about 25% of the workforce is women. And when we speak about software engineering, that level goes even further down. So about 92% software developers are men, which then tends to portray the sort of workplace culture where bias is very prevalent, whether or not it's intended. And then that becomes something that gets coded into the systems, then that gets ignored into the systems that are being built, and sort of then ties into the substantive perspective that we spoke about earlier. So I think the way to counter that kind of bias and the way to counter that kind of oversight is to make sure that we're countering it both from a substantive as well as a participatory perspective. And that's the kind of recommendation that I put out in my research as well.
Let's talk about the threats emerging or threats posed by artificial intelligence. What is the militarization? What is the weaponization of artificial intelligence and emerging technologies? If you could give us some examples how these are being deployed.
It's very hard to define how artificial intelligence is employed on battlefields, simply because of the fact that the technology changes every few years and it's hard to keep a track of how it's changed. So the same AI that we were talking about 10 years ago is not the same AI we're talking about today. So the way that AI has been employed on battlefields has also changed as a result. I think one of the most common technologies that we talk about when we speak about tech and military AI is the lethal autonomous weapon systems, which are basically systems where there is very little to no human oversight of the system at all. And this can be either in the form of uncrewed vehicles, whether they're uncrewed aerial vehicles, uncrewed ground vehicles, or uncrewed marine vehicles. This can also be in the form of other systems, for example, sentry guns, which may have AI-enabled systems as well. But apart from that, apart from the battlefield perspective, it may also be behind the scenes in logistical and administrative functioning of the military, sort of the entire military as a whole, whether it's in battlefield planning or management, whether it's in data management, whether it's logistics, whether it's any other system that sort of uses AI to make mi the military's task easier and faster. This can also include things like, for example, translators. On some in some national security applications of AI, especially where they're applied on national borders, a lot of soldiers are now being equipped with instantaneous translators, which translate between two languages on the border in real time. So these are also the sort of uses of AI that we've seen so far. But of course, there's a lot more in the pipeline just because of the fact that now we have this this entire new host of technologies under generative AI. And the potential for the application of AI has now increased as a result. Since the technology is a lot more powerful, there's a lot more application use case potential that we can observe as a result. So apart from just battlefield perspectives, we're also looking at how dual use this technology is. I mentioned before that the same technology you're using in your facial recognition on the phone is the one that's on these drones as well. But we're seeing a lot more of this. For example, the same recommendation systems that you have on, say, Netflix, which recommend what to watch next, might be employed in battlefield situations to recommend a certain course of action for the commanders and operators who are on the battlefield. For example, it'll look at the battlefield environment and it'll tell you, this is the data that I have, this is how I've processed the data, and this is my recommended course of action as a result. If you agree, let's proceed with this. So that's the kind of recommendation system that's also being applied in these scenarios.
What's the role of the United Nations and your institute in particular, Disarmament Research Institute, to address these emerging challenges?
Since these challenges are not bound to a certain nation or a certain community or a certain industry, they are very, very multinational, international, and global in nature. And there is no way that one single entity, one single country, one single state can come up with a solution that can be applied to everybody across the world. So I think international organizations like the UN then play a very critical role in ensuring that there is a platform where different states, different organizations, different individuals can come in, sort of lay down their perspective on how these should be governed, and then contribute to a global sort of conversation where we collectively decide how to make sure that these systems don't adversely affect anybody or any particular section of society. And I think in this particular conversation, what is also very essentially required is a solid bank of knowledge so that you know exactly what you're talking about. And even if you don't know exactly what you're talking about, you have enough of conjecture to know that this is within the scope of the conversation that we're having. And that kind of knowledge making happens over a course of time through dedicated efforts. So that's where organizations like mine, the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research, come in, because we conduct very targeted research on these particular issue areas, whether it's security and technology, whether it's disarmament through the lens of weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical weapons, gender and disarmament, Middle East, and weapons of mass destruction, as well as the space conversations around weapons and securitization of space. So we look at sort of all of these areas in detail, and we have dedicated teams of experts who look at them, and then come up with research that fills these policy gaps. Wherever policymakers and experts who come to these discussions to formulate policies have questions. For example, in my field, the question would be, where does gender fit into the fabric of security and technology? That is where we come in and sort of fill that gap with the research that we do. And once we have that body of research, we put out substantive reports, which then give a clear idea and a clearer picture of what we're seeing, what we're missing, and what we should be seeing. Then the conversation at these policy forums also becomes enriched. So I think places like the UN and also UNIDAID in particular are absolutely critical in these kind of discussions, and to make sure that building a safer world, not just for the people who it affects most, but for everybody who might in the future also be affected.